The opinions expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Fun, the For Us Network.
Please fasten your seatbelts.
Hello and welcome to Sock Into Politics. I'm Ed Pasok. Today we are going to discuss, like every other living being on this planet, the aftermath of the U.S. election. Or is it the aftermath? Is the election still going on? Some people seem to think so. But then some people seem to think Donald Trump is the second coming of Christ. So we'll be discussing that. We'll be discussing some Canadian reactions before the election and since. And we'll also be, if we get the time, discussing what's going on in Ontario, Manitoba, BC, places where these COVID cases are spiking in Ontario to record numbers, and try to figure out what the hell's going on. What are we doing wrong? What can we do differently? But first, we're going to stay in Canada. Yesterday, there was news that came out from Lisa Raitt, who is a former Conservative cabinet minister, who is now caring for her husband, who has early or young onset dementia. Now, anybody who's cared for anybody who has dementia understands that this is possibly the worst thing that can happen to an individual and their family. I know there's other diseases that involve lots of pain and wasting away, and that is terrible. But when you see somebody who looks physically like they're there, but mentally they're not there, and they don't recognize you some days, or they recognize you one point, another time they don't recognize you, they get often they can get very frustrated and get very angry. They can sometimes get violent. It's very, very difficult to be a caregiver for somebody who's got that. Never mind what the individual in question is going through, which it's rare for them to be able to communicate that directly. But I think we understand that this is a horrible circumstance, regardless of what we think of Lisa Raitt politically. But Aaron Seal, who's with us, as well as Samantha Eamon and Hafiz Noorani, had personal experience working with Lisa Raitt in politics for a number of years. And he has a unique perspective on what he saw or what he read coming from Lisa Raitt yesterday. And because neither Sam nor Hafiz nor I have this experience, we're going to step back for a minute and we're going to let Aaron express his thoughts and concerns on this particular topic as somebody who has direct information and direct experience with Lisa Raitt. Aaron?
Thank you. I'll start by saying that I wish nothing but the best for Bruce. His condition, I can only imagine the hell that he's living in. And if he's listening and hearing this, you have a friend and somebody's there for you. I'm going to talk about Lisa, and I'm coming at this from a subversive perspective because I read the narrative in the Global News article that came out on November 9th by Nick Westall. And I react to it, and this is me with my opinion and my reaction. I'm very concerned. Not all caregivers are created equal. Quality of care matters, and I know that firsthand because I went through the most severe depression imaginable. I was hospitalized on a number of occasions. I received very high quality medical care from a number of hospitals, and my life was literally saved by quality care. I've also witnessed the system at its worst. My history with Lisa Raitt is personal. I worked 8 years on the Harper era staff, first for Prime Minister Harper himself in the Prime Minister's office, then for Ministers Flaherty and Clement. And in those roles, I intersected with literally everyone in cabinet. Lisa Raitt is on the record with a history of staff scapegoating. Jasmine McDonnell in 2009, the story as it goes, was dismissed as a denouement for a tape recorder gone amiss. And that's just one of the many newsworthy stories from that era of Lisa Raitt, but that's the one specific one on scapegoating. And it reflects a narrative behind the scenes about the way Minister Raitt treated staff. And I read this article, I read the eyes in this article, I read the extent to which it is focused on her interest and need, I read her perspective on his condition, I read his symptoms, and I just think this doesn't seem right. And I can think of a number of ways that this could be playing out, but one that pops in my mind is if he doesn't want her there, and you can imagine various reasons why that could be, because she acknowledges in the article that the marriage was not good to begin with. If her presence is in fact contributing to the problem, he's not in a position to voice that. Hence my concern.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of supposition there. I understand this comes with a lot of emotion for you and a lot of personal experience with her, but there's a lot of supposition there. And it is not unusual, and as somebody who has seen dementia up close more than once, it is not unusual for people who are loving spouses to have the spouse with dementia suddenly turn on them because they're the person that's there day in, day out. There's lots of reasons why, but just because somebody says, I don't want you here, doesn't mean that they actually, if they were in their right capacities, wouldn't want them there. And I think that I understand what you're, if I understand what you're saying, you notice that a lot of what she was talking about wasn't concern for his condition, but concern for what his condition meant for her life. Is that correct?
That's one part of the story. The second part of the story, and I'm going to quote directly from it, one of the few pieces that actually talks about him where his behavior is described, and I'll read it verbatim. She posted a video of Twitter of Wood pacing in their bedroom, saying a few words at a time and making sounds. At one point, he cursed while throwing what appears to be a glove. What can I do? Rape can be heard asking. I don't know. Get up and go right now, Jesus Christ, Wood replied, before growling, kicking a piece of furniture and leaving the room. In the video, Ray can be heard telling Wood she would leave. When I think about my personal depression experience, that brings up trauma memories of me trying to communicate messages and them just not being understood. It seems perfectly logical to me, however much of a supposition that it is, that if he doesn't want her around and he's looking for an alternative that doesn't seem to exist and he's just stuck there, those behaviors make sense to me.
Well, you're not an expert on dementia, am I correct?
Not an expert on dementia, I'm an expert in depression.
Okay, they're not the same thing here. And as somebody who's experienced family members with dementia, his behavior is not unusual. It doesn't say that he's calling for help. If he's calling for help, he's calling for help more than likely from this disease, which has robbed him of his faculties. And while I understand the concern that based on your personal knowledge of Lisa Raitt, as being somebody who is rather selfish and self-absorbed, I can see also the point of view whereby caregivers often get overlooked when people talk about what's going on with the people who they're giving care to, and caregivers get drained, and caregivers get suicidal, and caregivers get sick, because everything is so focused on the person being cared, it seems selfish to call attention to the caregiver saying, help, I need help too. And maybe people will come forward, caregivers, because of seeing what she's had to say, and say, yeah, you're right. I love the person I'm caring for, but I need help too. Maybe somebody with a public profile saying this will cause people to recognize that it is not selfish to care about yourself, because when somebody is drowning, you don't jump in with them. You throw something to help them, or you use a stick to pull them in. With caregivers, you jump right in, and you can drown too. And people, I think, need to recognize that as well, with all respect to your concerns.
With all respect, yes. I'll just say just one thing in the context of what you've just said, Ed, not all caregivers are created equal.
Of course they're not.
I was going to add a point to that. Is you know, yes, caregivers face a lot of stress as well. But what do we do in a country when we're not sure if the person receiving care is getting it from the right caregiver? Now, in a situation where your family member becomes a caregiver, what steps are we taking to make sure that that person is providing the right amount of care and isn't letting their relationship with the person get in the way of providing that care in a unbiased manner? It's a really, really messy situation if you ask me. from what I've heard, and I wouldn't want to be in it. And I don't wish ill on anyone, and it just seems sad. And I mean I can't imagine if what it must be like if there was a relationship issue and now you're stuck with someone in you know those later years, and you're in a care bond with them. So
well, it flips the other way too. I've known situations where relationships weren't great, but all of a sudden somebody took ill and the partner stepped in to provide care, and the relationship wasn't great for them either, but at the same time they care enough that they won't let the person founder on their own, and there's nobody else to step in. This is a quagmire, and it obviously raises issues that we've discussed, but I think that that being said, we can wish the rate Bruce Wood family well, and recognize that caregivers do need to be able to express that they are drowning without feeling like people are going to look at them as being selfish. So let's take that from this and let's move on to the next topic. Are we all good?
Yep.
All right. Next topic. Talk about a relationship that is impaired. The U.S. election, where we've got one side that clearly was a decisive winner in the Electoral College with clear multiples of pluralities of votes separating them from the loser. And yet you've got the loser saying that, no, they still have a path to victory. This reminds me of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, when he's cutting down the Black Knight, cutting off his limbs.
A flesh wound.
It's just a flesh wound, nothing but a scratch, not recognizing that, no, you're defeated. Every state that came in for Biden was another limb being cut off of Donald Trump's reelection hopes. And yet we've got a situation where there's fear that Donald Trump is trying to engineer a coup. I don't even know how realistic that is, how realistic it is he could possibly do that. But the fact that he's done so many things before that nobody had thought anybody could get away with, I understand the fear. But let's talk about the election process. Let's talk about the election results and what the fact that we're still sitting here over a week later and Republicans refuse to acknowledge that Donald Trump lost, still claiming that, no, it's just a flesh wound. What are your thoughts on this whole process, Sam?
Okay, well, elections are usually journalist Christmas, but I can't describe this one that way.
I think this is more like a salesman's boxing day for you guys.
Tell me about it. So we spent the whole day, the actual election day, me telling, all my writers, don't make a call. We're not going to have official results tonight. And it may be a while before anything is ratified or certified, rather. I was watching it, like in 2016, there was a point where everyone realized it was turning. And that was Florida in 2016. As soon as we knew he had Florida, which was kind of a given, but whatever, we knew that Donald Trump was going to win. And similarly, this time, it was a lot longer. This was a very drawn out process. It was very stressful from a journalistic point of view, because you're trying to inform people as much as you can and give as much context while telling them, wait, we can't give you anything yet. And it was just, there was the turning point didn't come until, a couple of days later. So it's like this prolonged tension of just, is he going to get back in? Now, personally, for me, I'm like, even if Biden gets the votes, I'm still convinced, and I'm seeing it now, Trump isn't going to leave. He's going to have to be removed. And I did catch a little bit of criticism for saying that, because I couldn't make myself celebrate when Biden was projected. Because I know what a challenge it's going to be to get Donald Trump to physically leave the White House.
That's what forklifts are for.
Yeah, he was on the golf course while he made Rudy Giuliani go up in front of a landscaping company. And
well, that's, you know, what they need to do. What they need to do is, when Trump is out golfing next time, just change the locks on the White House.
Look, yeah.
Just change the locks so he can't get in anymore.
It's clear with Donald Trump. It's what Bill Maher called him in the beginning. He's a whiny little bitch, and he's going to raise a lot of fuss. He's going to kick. He's going to scream, but there isn't a fucking thing he can do, really. He's going to have to leave the White House, and he knows that. He's going to say he's not going to leave. He's going to act like that kid in the playground that wants to break the toy because it's not his toy and he has to share it. He's going to cause chaos in the next two, 3 weeks. His Republican enablers, that's where the problem really is. Because
exactly. Yeah.
It is one thing for a complete asshole of a man. I'm sorry, there's no good words to describe him.
What do you mean? That's a perfectly good word to describe him.
No, I meant words that are good, like positive words. No, there's only negative words to describe him. There's no recourse that he can enact in his power to stay in power. Now, Van Jones was talking about a situation where, you know, electoral college voters might not follow along, or, you know, a situation where it has to be ratified in the House of in the House of Representatives, and where they vote on state lines, not on one vote per representative, and he could win that way. But I don't think in America, an absolute removal of power from the electorate is just going to be able to be pushed through without any effort stopping it. And I think the U.S. system within itself is ready to move him. The military, the Secret Service. If you look at Biden, his Secret Service people have now tripled. He's got all the security around him. The apparatus of the state is moving in the direction of making Biden the next president, whether Donald Trump likes it or not.
All right, Aaron.
So I agree with Hafiz completely that Trump isn't going to go quietly. We may have what may be callable chaos, but I'd call it staged chaos. And I say that out of respect for President Trump, because like him or hate him, he has served his country for 4 years and he's built a brand on patriotism. I don't believe that this is a man who's going to do harm to his country on the way out. And I don't believe that his base is
doing harm to his country on his way out.
If you believe that, then you have probably voted against him. But there are clearly a whole bunch of Americans that feel he's done a good job and would rather have had
Aaron, him saying he did not lose the election and that he won is an act of someone trying to stage a coup. It's not democratic. It's
your
not
words.
Doing anything.
Words.
No. Words have meaning and action when you are the president of the United States.
They're not
States.
Just words, because the GSA, under the direction of the president, the sitting president, won't let the Biden camp have access to the resources that the president-elect usually gets.
Well, that's different. And resources in the back office are a matter of custom and tradition. The idea that those traditions should flow in the exact same manner through time is never the case. And if you've worked through a transition of power, there's all kind of stuff that changes and updates. And if there's stuff
not this, on- Aaron, not, yeah, but, not
no,
this.
No, there's nothing positive we could put. Yeah.
But let's also remember that both Mitch McConnell and Mike Pompeo. Like, Mike Pompeo said it bluntly. He's like, we're going to be transitioning to a second Trump administration. That is a Secretary of State on public record saying that on television.
That was like, foolish of Mike Pompeo.
Yeah, but you think
he's
the
Secretary
that
of State. And Mitch McConnell is also doing the same thing. He's saying Trump's fully within his rights to, start essentially the transition. Yeah, the lawsuits, which will likely all be thrown out. But it doesn't matter. Mitch McConnell is in for a penny, in for a pound. And I think that's exactly why he's saying and doing what he's doing.
I think the bigger question here,
for a long time, and now he's got to follow this all the way through.
what we're seeing here is the potential transition from democracy to autocratic rule, because
specifically with conservatism.
Well, I'm surprised, quite frankly, that the Republicans are still on board with him, because logically, I would think that the Republicans who've lived in fear of this man for 4 years would have, as soon as he was defeated, recognized that he was impotent and rushed to take the power back to themselves and away from this bully. The fact that they're still backing him up is kind of ridiculous.
They want his voters.
I think you've captured right there the problem with the Canadian perspective on Trump, which is the belief that opposition to him is as strong internally within the Republican Party as it is on a widespread basis in Canada. It's just factually not true. There are a lot of people who, disagree with them or not, think Trump was a great president. And those people are not going quietly into the night. And so that's why my opinion of the election on social media is, if you're congratulating this result right now, I stand with you. From my perspective personally, and from a Canadian perspective, Joe Biden was by far the better choice. But from my perspective going forward is that the Trump machine, with a better lead character, dominates U.S. politics. So be prepared for the possibility that the policies that Trump was advancing with a better headliner may do pretty well down the road.
And that scares the shit out of me.
Trumpism isn't dead. However, I think what is dead is any concept of conservatism being a ideology that is connected to democratic rule. It is not. It is, if you're looking at it, whether it's...
Let's separate conservatism from Republicanism.
I'm not going to, and I'll tell you why. You look at what's happening with conservative leaders like this around the world, whether it's Viktor Orban, and you look at what's happening in Europe. This is a movement towards autocracy that is coming from the right wing, and it needs to be called out, because these people have used... the concept of democracy and being the bearers of democracy for far too long. And now they're moving away from it because the world is moving away from them.
So we also have players like Lindsey Graham and Ted Cruz and all of these other people who I will maintain. I don't believe that they personally like Trump or believe in him or anything else. I think that they had certain issues that they wanted to get through. And Trump allowed them to do that. And they sacrificed respecting their leader so that they could push through certain issues, certain socially conservative issues that they've been trying to push for a very long time. So these guys all bought in, thinking they could control Trump somehow and get their agendas done. Their socially conservative fundamentalist views, they could get them through the vehicle of Trump. They didn't realize that they'd have to sacrifice everything from their own respect to do that, but now they've doubled down. They have to. They've spent 4 years sacrificing so many things in the greater party for their own personal vendettas, that now they have to support him now. If they turn on him now, then their party has fallen apart.
Well, you know what? I have to disagree with Aaron. While there's still some assumption that Trumpism will continue, I think that when you look around the world and look in history at cults of personality, which is what this is, the support of Trump is a cult of personality. When the personality disappears from power, the cult of personality tends to dissipate and go back to the fringes. I think that depending on who predominates in the Republican Party as they rebuild themselves after Trump, it is possible that Trumpism could continue with a different figurehead, perhaps somebody with a little bit more facility for selling it without being so blunt. But it's also possible that it could just dissipate and these people will go back to the fringes where they were before. It could go either way. My feeling is that we have to see who the next candidate is that's going to try to take up the mantle of Trumpism, because it's entirely possible that Trumpism is bound up with Trump, and that if you try to take it up and you're not Trump, they're not going to go with you, because Trumpism there's a lot of who Trump is, the Trump mythology mixed in there, because the Trump mythology is that he's a successful businessman, and he's not. The guy's run his businesses into the ground over and over again, and he's in deep debt. And obviously Trump is trying to stay president because if he's not president, he will get charged likely by the Southern District of New York for numerous infractions. There's legal cases going against him. He'll be in court for the foreseeable future defending himself, and he's going to have to face the fact that his businesses are going to crater once foreign leaders no longer have to cater to him, and he's going to have to deal with this massive debt that he has. So I understand why he's holding on for dear life, because in many ways he is holding on for dear life. But
he's frightened because
on that note, though, him and his team have been spam calling Trump supporters trying to get money under the guise of paying legal costs. Hang on, though. The fine print says that actually the money can also go to pay his campaign debts. He didn't pay for his campaign. He went into debt, and now he's trying to get his supporters to pay his
debts. He thought he was going to win, and he thought he was going to be able to pay off those debts, you know, and sweep them under away. But now he's responsible for those debts, and he needs to do all this stuff to raise money for that and for whatever he does next. And, you know, it's really funny because when you think of that archetype of a man and you know, being able to think of yourself as being a good winner, but also not being a sore loser. And Americans have always had this thing about really looking down on people that are sore losers. And now you're seeing this entire generation of men that, you know, cheer on sports athletes and whatnot and have always disliked people that are losers, that do not accept their downfall, now standing up with this. And it boggles my mind to see adult men stand up for a loser in a way that they do not accept the reality as well. And I think it's a big check on that dynamic of white men in America that thought that, you know, America will only move in the direction they choose. But what has resoundingly been shown is that people of color, especially in the growing cities like Atlanta, have a say in this decision, and they are saying something else.
Well, you know, it is very likely or very possible that all of this maneuvering, they know that they're out, but they're calling out the dogs to try to raise money to retire his campaign debt, because Lord knows he has enough debt without the campaign debt. And he's also positioning himself as, you know, he leads a movement of grievances. His movement is a bunch of people who are aggrieved. He has to continue to be aggrieved. He can't accept with equanimity that he lost, because he needs to be aggrieved. If he's not aggrieved, it's like a kind of like Tinkerbell in Peter Pan, where if you didn't believe in her, she was going to disappear. If he's not aggrieved, then he doesn't have any momentum going forward. And if he wants to start up Trump TV, which is what he actually was planning to do when he accidentally won last time, if he wants to start up Trump TV, he needs this aggrievement to launch that. He needs that well of emotion to launch that forward. And he needs also people to abandon Fox News, which they've been doing, because Fox News had the temerity to call the election in exactly the way the election fell. And so this is actually, I think, rather calculated in order to give him momentum moving forward when he leaves office to still be a force on a national level. Aaron, thoughts?
I've said my piece.
All right. I think that we should, an interesting sidelight to this is Jagmeet Singh, before the actual election, before the voting, endorsed Joe Biden. And there's reasons to discuss this. I'll first go with Sam, your thoughts on this?
Okay. So I don't see the issue with it. Like, I get that some people see an issue with this. I do not. I mean,
why?
Okay. So we're in Canada, and Jagmeet Singh is not in power.
Thank God.
And, oh, yeah, we'll get to that later. And honestly, he's from a left party, a progressive party. It's not a surprise. Why is everyone surprised?
I'll tell you why everyone's surprised, because it's bad strategy.
Bad strategy for what? No one ever.
No, it is bad strategy.
Because let Aaron talk. Let Aaron talk. Shut up, everybody else. Aaron.
He's made a probabilistic judgment in his mind that the consequences of that tweet being wrong on him and on the country are worth taking. And if he's making that judgment in the situation that's as close as this election turned out to be, that in my mind shows bad strategic judgment. There is an argument that you call the winner in advance to do any number of things like curry personal loyalty. In certain situations, and you've got to judge this election and Jagmeet's choice to do it based on the probabilities as you saw them beforehand and as it played out. And my read of the land is this was far too close of an election for any party leader who hopes to become prime minister to take aside, because the damage that will come of that tweet being wrong far exceeds any gain he hopes to get from it.
Well, let me ask you this.
The hypocrisy of this is...
Can I have a point?
Sorry. All right, hold on. Hafiz sounds pathetic there. Can I have a point, please?
Can I
sir, can I have some more? Look. All right, Hafiz.
Look, he's a fourth party. I get it. But I think as the NDP, having this as your leader is...
Hold on. He's a third place party.
Third place? But third, I mean, isn't the block ahead of him?
I don't consider the Bloc a national party.
No. Yeah, but no. It's not a national. Look, the Bloc can do better. Can run members all across the country if they wanted. The fact remains, they still have more seats than the NDP. The NDP has no power in opposition right now, other than the mantle of Jagmeet Singh. And you know, when you kind of see why maybe some people may have called him Jughead back in the day, because. This guy clearly does not have a clue.
The deuce you say, who would do such a thing?
Well, who would ever call this guy Jughead? Well, you know what? For people that defended him before, I think you kind of get what you pay for. And look, Jagmeet Singh and Donald Trump are both examples of politicians that suck, as my opinion goes.
Well, thank you for that very deep analysis.
No Canadian politician should be talking about another country's leader and who they want, because if that happened to our country, we'd be up in arms. And it's just a general form of respect. Now, the way the Trudeau government and Aaron O'Toole's gone about it is far more how do I say democratic and that's not the word I'm looking for. Either way, it's the right way about going about it.
All right, Sam.
If we want to get technical, Justin Trudeau has already called Biden, and both the CPC and the Liberals have put out their congratulations. By the way, these are all still projections. The vote has not been certified. The Electoral College process has not gone through. So technically, everybody's early, okay?
Oh, come on, Sam.
Everybody's early.
No, there's a big difference between doing something before the votes are cast and doing something after the votes are counted. They're not the same.
This election is a special case, and I'll tell you why.
People around the world, leaders around the world have called to congratulate Joe Biden.
I think it would be more concerning if we did have any politicians come out for Trump.
But that's not what we're discussing.
This is morality versus
That's not what we're discussing. What we're discussing is whether Singh should have jumped a gun and said it. And I have a question for Aaron, based on what Aaron said. Aaron, do you really think that in the U.S. that really only pays attention to American news, they give one half testicle about what Jagmeet Singh said about who he sees as a better candidate for the election? Do you think they actually give a shit about what I don't even know that Canadians give a shit about what he had to say. Do you really think that there's a real strategic error here? Can he really go wrong? The guy is not in any potential, line of succession for possibly being the next prime minister. Does it really make any difference whatsoever? Like if a tree falls in the forest and Jagmeet Singh is there to say the tree fell, does anybody care?
If we find ourselves in 2025 with Prime Minister Jagmeet Singh and President Donald Trump Jr., that tweet will come back to haunt us all.
I think this is a way smaller deal than it
is. But then again,
and it's being made into a big deal because it's sink. Like, I get it.
Well, it was stupid. It was stupid, but no big deal, really.
Yeah, it's not a big deal. And I think you just negated your own point by saying, do we really care that he endorsed Biden? And the answer is no. So, I mean, this is a non-issue. It's a non-issue.
Jagmeet Singh is a non-issue. That's the thing. And I thank you for making that clear, that we shouldn't ever be taking this politician seriously.
The answer to that is Aaron O'Toole.
The answer to that is Justin Trudeau, who's, you know, leading the country in the right direction right now, and who is a stable leader that we can all sort of, you know, connect behind.
Not everybody feels that way. Come on, not everybody feels that way. Not everybody feels that he's doing a good job. Not everybody feels connected.
They should refund their CERB checks then.
No, because
I
think that no matter who was in power, we would have had CERB. It doesn't matter who was in power.
If the conservatives were in charge,
if the NDP were in power, we would have had more.
I'm not sure necessarily we needed to have more. I'm not sure we could afford more, but that's water under the bridge. All right. We were going to talk about Ontario. We're going to put that over till next week because I think it's entirely likely that next week we'll continue to see large spikes in corona cases. Ontario, Manitoba's gone to a red alert as we're recording this. BC,
lockdown.
Yeah, things are worse than they were before as far as number of cases. What are we doing wrong? Well, we'll try to discuss that next week. And until then, it's time for us to say sayonara. Can we say sayonara? Is that cultural appropriation, Aaron?
It sounds about right to me. Anyone can call us out on it if they want to.
Sam, is sayonara from the left, is that cultural appropriation?
No comment.
All right. Well, then I'm going to say sayonara on behalf of Samantha Eamon, Hafiz Noorani, and Aaron Seal, coming to us from Sam's in Ontario. Hafiz is in BC. Aaron is in Quebec. So this is a pan-Canadian discussion, even though we all speak English and we didn't speak French. Though I think that Aaron can speak French.
I'm super.
All right. That's it. I'm Ed the Sock. I want to thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed this program, well, first of all, you have very low standards, but I appreciate those standards. And if you want to hear more of these programs, as opposed to us saying, hey, you know what? People don't seem to care. Let's just roll up the carpet and get out of here. Then if you want to have these things continue, takes a little effort on your part too. Don't tell me you don't have $5 that you can give us for every month. Don't tell me you don't have five. If you don't have $5, keep it. You legitimately need it more than we do. But I know that you got $5 that you would spend every day without even thinking about it. I'm asking you for $5 a month. It's $1.25 a week. Bupkis, nothing, nil, nada. Don't you tell me you can't afford $5 a week to keep this kind of conversation, this kind of entertainment going. We take conversations and we bring them down to the level that people can really understand them without talking like the media elites, the pundits, the paid proxies. We talk the way you talk, all right? And we will make these issues understandable. So if you want this to continue, because you guys don't start coughing up more $5, I'm ready to say to hell with a whole Olalia. So $5. Don't tell me you can't afford $5. $5 on patreon.com. That's right, patreon.com. Join up. Be a member of the team. patreon.com/FUNetworkTV. Or if you want to give a one-time donation, that is also appreciated. You can do it at PayPal through our PayPal email address, which is FUNetworkTV@gmail.com. So do that, will you? And that's it. I'm Ed the Sock. This has been Sock It to Politics on the Fun Network.